And so, you know, here you have renunciation, the first watch of the night, the great compassion in bodhicitta, the second watch of the night. And then the third watch of the night was when, through meditating on emptiness, he purified his mind of all of the defilements, and he gained the understanding of the distinction of the defilements, the distinction of, sometimes it's called outflows or cankers, or there's various ways to translate it, but all the defiling factors of the mind. In particular, in the Pali Canon, they talk about three and sometimes four of these asvaras, or that's the Pali word for it. So the first one is sensual desire, so the mind that is just hooked on to sense objects, okay? So that one's been abandoned. And then the desire to exist. And I think what I understand by this is the self-grasping ignorance. You know, the mind that says, I have to exist. And that's got to be the mind that comes up at the end of each life that causes us to grasp onto new aggregates in the next life. Okay? Is this desire to exist. Yeah. So it doesn't mean when you give up the desire to exist that you stop existing. It's, you know, this means the having the craving for existence that leads you to samsaric rebirths. Okay, you getting what I'm saying? Because an enlightened being also exists, but they don't have this desire to exist. Okay, so don't think it means total annihilation. Then the third one is wrong views. So all the wrong views have been abandoned. And then when they talk of four outflows, this is in the Pali Canon, then they also include ignorance as one of them. Okay, so the basic defilements that keep you in cyclic existence. And he actually directly perceived, you know, the reality of the Four Noble Truths and dependent arising and the 12 links. And so through that, he was able to stop his own rebirth in cyclic existence and attain full enlightenment. Of course, you know, when he was meditating that evening, it wasn't smooth for him, you know, as the story goes. It wasn't that he sat down and went into a samadhi and, you know, was all blissed out. You know, he sat down, and what happens? Well, first of all, Mara, who is, you know, the personification of, Mara is kind of like the devil, but actually what Mara is our self-centered mind and our self-grasping ignorance, okay? So the self-centered mind, the self-grasping ignorance, anthropomorphized, being displayed as a living being. So Mara comes along and, you know, emanates all these weapons and armies and soldiers and, you know, Rambo type of guys and, you know, everybody who's going and attacking the Buddha. So here's the Buddha meditating and having all these incredible hindrances and looks like spirits and warriors and everybody trying to kill him and everything. What it really is, you know, that's how the story goes. What it really is, you know, what happens when, what's really going on when we're seeing enemies all over the place? Okay? It's the karmic result of our own hatred, of our own fear, of our own having harmed others in the past, motivated by malicious mind. So, you know, when the Buddha's having this vision of all these armies and enemies, you know, to bring it to, relate it to our level, he's dealing with his anger. Yeah? So, you know, don't get discouraged when you're meditating and working with your anger, thinking, you know, oh, you know, Siddhartha, he just had it so easy. He was born as a Buddha. You know, no, he struggled with it too. Okay. So then he turned all of the weapons into flowers, so that instead of there being a rain of weapons, there was a rain of flowers. And so in our own practice, when we are bombarded by, you know, negative thoughts and hatred and anger and fear and suspicion and aggression, then we meditate on loving kindness. Yeah, so we turn it all into beautiful flowers, turn the enemy into a teacher. So then Mara tried another trick. And instead of sending weapons and armies, he sent beautiful women. Yeah? And so they're all sitting there. There's the Buddha trying to meditate. And, you know, the object of all of his sexual attachment is there dancing all around him, you know. So, you know, that's like our mind, isn't it? How our mind goes bananas over things that we find attractive, you know, material possessions. I would say sexual attachments probably, you know, and relationships probably the strongest attachment that we have. That's why it's, you know, expressed in this way in the story. And, you know, you're just tormented by all your own lust and attachment and craving and clinging and longing and yearning. And we've all been through it, right? Okay, so how did the Buddha deal with it? Well, he transformed, you know, this image of all these beautiful women around him. He transformed them all into old hags. Okay, so what that means for us in our own practice is seeing that all the things that we are attracted to really are not so beautiful. Yeah, we're sitting here craving some delicious food, but if you leave it out overnight, it looks really terrible. Or you're craving, you know, some having a lot of sexual attachment, but if you look at the insides of the body of the person that you're craving, it's not so beautiful, you know. Or you're craving a new car, and then you look at, you know, the grease and the petrol, and, you know, it's not so beautiful. So you begin to see that all these things that we're attached to that we think we need just, you know, really don't cut it. Okay, so, you know, he was able to let go of that. So I think, you know, in the story, it's making analogies to our own life and how we need to practice, you know, seeing the unsatisfactoriness or the loathsomeness of the objects of attachment. And so this is why in the Tibetan tradition, you know, sometimes they recommend that you go meditate in a cemetery and a charnel ground, okay? Because your fear comes up, and charnel grounds, at least in ancient times, they weren't like Forest Lawn, which was a park and an art gallery, but they were, you know, really rather disgusting things, because they would just take the bodies and throw them there, you know, so the bodies are decomposing and the flies are eating them and the bugs are eating them and they stink and they're bloated and the whole things. There's a whole series of meditations that we do called Asubha. Say that right? Asubha. The Asubha meditations. So again, the Pali word. And that's meditating on the body as being kind of ugly, you know? In other words, stopping the peeling off the skin and seeing what the body really is. Okay. And also seeing what the skin really is. So in the Theravada tradition, they do this a lot. When I was in Thailand last October, we were doing that meditation. And in Thailand, they, you know, because it's a Buddhist country, the monks, the monastics, can request a hospital to go and see an autopsy. And so I asked the master of the temple where I was if he could arrange that, and he did, and we went to see an autopsy. And I have pictures of it, anybody wants to see. And then I also have pictures that Barry sent me, those of you who know Barry from DFF, of the tsunami victims, you know. I think they were taken like one day after the tsunami, and just incredible what the body looks like. But you do these kinds of meditations to see the ugly aspect of what you're attached to, and your attachment goes away real quick. Yeah. Shantideva also taught this technique. He described it in Chapter 8 of Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, so it's found in the Tibetan tradition as well. Very effective meditation. And very, you know, it's quite interesting, you know, because you would think that if you did that meditation, that your mind would just get disgusted and feel gloomy and feel blech all the time, you know, because you're just dissecting the body in your meditation. But actually, my experience is that doing that meditation makes my mind so calm, makes my mind really calm, because by understanding what the body is, my mind is no longer interested in the things that it's usually flittering about and worrying about. Because you see what the body is, you see what the nature of, you know, our body is indicative of our samsara, and you see what it really is, and then you go, this is not so great looking. So then all the stuff that we usually worry about that, you know, has to do with our body, and is my body healthy, and is it clean, and is it good looking, and have I eaten the kind of food I like and avoided the kind of food I don't like, and have I exercised enough, and do I bulge where I want to bulge and not bulge where I don't want to bulge, and how's my cholesterol doing, and what do my clothes look like, and what do people think of how I look, and, you know, are my glasses nice looking glasses, or are they funny ones, and am I wearing the right clothes so I fit in with everybody else, and what do people think of me, and, you know, all this stuff you just don't think about anymore. Okay, when you really do these meditations on the nature of the body. So, like I said, my experience was that your mind just gets really calm. Yeah, really calm. And then, you know, that calm mind can be used to meditate on other topics, because it's not always distracted by other stuff. Yeah, I mean, if you see the nature of this body and you think about, you know, here's my consciousness. Yeah, my consciousness stuck in this body by the force of ignorance. And at the time I die, I'm just going to do it again if I don't stop this and get attached to another body that looks just as disgusting as this one, you know. And then worry about that body and try and make that body look good. And, you know, it's like, no, enough already, enough. Basta finito, you know, I gotta stop this. So I'm quite helpful in that way. It doesn't make you depressed. At least that wasn't my experience. Okay, so, you know, these stories about how the Buddha attained enlightenment are also, you know, indicative of how we should practice. So then the dawn of the full moon day was when he attained enlightenment. And at first, after the Buddha attained enlightenment, he did some walking meditation. And he was thinking, nobody's ever going to understand what I just experienced. You know, this is just, you know, here he has the highest enlightenment, his mind's completely free, and he's saying, how is anybody else going to relate to what I've experienced? They have no idea, you know. They're all sitting there worrying about their raspberries and their crops and their, you know, their sons and daughters getting married and who likes them and who doesn't like them and how much income they're having. He said, who's ever going to understand what I've realized? And so he just wasn't going to teach at all. And then, as the story goes, the powerful gods, who were coincidentally the gods that were worshipped, the worldly gods that were worshipped at that time by people in general society. So, Buddhism didn't refute all the religious figures of the religion of the society it came into. It just incorporated them and said, oh yeah, there's Brahma and, you know, Sakra and all these other, you know, Indra, all these other gods, but they're just worldly gods. They're not enlightened beings. Okay, so, you know, just instead of refute them, incorporate them. So then all these, as the story goes, so then all these worldly gods come and bow down to the Buddha and say, but there's a few beings with little dust in their eyes. So in their wisdom beings, there are some people who don't have a lot of dust. You know, among sentient beings, the wisdom eye of some of them is a little bit clear. So it's worthwhile for you to teach. And so they requested him to teach. Okay. And so then the Buddha decided to teach. Now, what's interesting in this story is if you consider the Buddha being an enlightened being already, is he ever not going to teach? Think about it. You know, the whole reason you became enlightened is to benefit sentient beings. Are you ever just not going to teach? No. But the story is developed this way for our benefit, to show here are these great worldly gods going and requesting teachings. Okay? So the story, what it's symbolizing for us, is not to take the teachings for granted. And, you know, we have to be eager and have little dust in our wisdom eye and actually go and request them. Okay? So the Buddha, when he decided to teach, then he was thinking, well, who am I going to teach? And he first thought of his two teachers, you know, the ones who had taught him the jhana meditation. But they had both just passed away. Then he thought of his five companions who he did the ascetic practice with. And he knew that they were in Sarnath at the Deer Park there. So he said, well, I'll go there and teach them what I've discovered. So he set out walking to Sarnath. When he got there, his five friends saw him coming in the distance, and they went, oh, there's Siddhartha the flake who couldn't handle the ascetic discipline that we were keeping. When he comes, don't offer him a seat, don't offer him anything to drink, don't offer to clean his feet, just ignore him. But, you know, as the Buddha was walking towards him, just his presence, who he was as a living being, had this powerful impact on them, and automatically their minds changed and they prepared a seat for him and got water for him to drink and washed his feet, so on. You know, so I find that also interesting in the story. It's like the Buddha didn't need to come and say, I'm enlightened, I'm this, I'm this. It was just who he was, you know, emanated what was going on inside. And people picked up on it. And it's interesting because a number of people have told me that, you know, they're not Buddhist or anything, but His Holiness Dalai Lama will be teaching somewhere, and they'll go to hear him teach, and he'll walk in the room, and they'll just start crying. And they don't know why they're crying. And they've never heard him, they've never met him, but they just start crying. Several people have told me this. And I think it's that same dynamic. It's just like who he is as a living being emanates. And, you know, you get... you communicate on some other level. Okay, so his friends, you know, wound up welcoming him. And so it was to him that he gave the first discourse. And his first discourse was on the Four Noble Truths. Okay, now actually, we call it the Four Noble Truths, but what it actually should be is the four things seen as true by the noble ones. Okay, noble ones mean those who have seen reality directly, non-conceptually. Okay, so it's the four things seen as true by people who know what they're talking about because they've seen reality directly. They're the noble ones. Okay, so these noble ones have seen that dukkha is true, you know, that the cause, the origin of dukkha, you know, is true, it exists, that there's a way out, or that there's a state beyond that, there's a cessation of that, and that there's a path to practice. So, you know, a noble one has seen that you know, these four things are really true, and they've seen it with their own wisdom eye. Okay. But we abbreviate all that into the Four Noble Truths. Okay. Because, and I explain that because if you think about it, then somebody could say, well, what's noble about dukkha? There's nothing noble about dukkha. Well, you're right, you know. But the truth of dukkha, you know, is seen by people who are noble, who have seen reality directly. And so then one of them, well, actually by the end of the second discourse that he gave them, then all five of his friends had, I think they had all become arhats, or at least they had become noble beings, but, you know, they had attained realization. And then from there on, you know, the Buddha started going around ancient India teaching, yeah, and he and living his life, you know, as he lived it, and teaching for 45 years. And so we'll talk some more about, you know, how he taught and what went on, you know, in the next day. But I think it's very helpful in thinking about the Buddha's life and the society, what it was like, the social milieu at the time, to see how this also relates to our life and our situation, you know, and to look at the elements of the story that may have been mythologized. It doesn't really matter if it's truth or myth. The point is that it's useful in our mind, and to see how those things, how we can make them useful in our own practice, in our own mind.